Welcome back to another episode of the Midwest Monsters Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Grizzly Abner, and I'm joined by
Professor Wagstaff,
Venomous Vinny.
Good to be with you again, friends. And we are coming back with our newest series, I think. Yeah, this seems like the newest format we've done.
Correct.
Introduced.
Yeah.
Ranking films by decade. Ranking decades by film, film by decade, whatever you want to go, however that works for you. But so we take a decade. And we pick our top 10 favorite movies from that decade.
Yeah. I think it's a fun exercise to really cover a lot of ground quickly. Plus, I always like hearing people throw out some of their favorites. And, you know, hopefully in the process, I know we've gotten a little bit of feedback from people close to the show that it's kind of put some shows on the radar for them, mm-hmm. which is fun.
We've done 50s, aughts, and...
We kicked off with the 80s.
We kicked off with the 80s, yep. Okay.
Aughts were surprising.
Yeah, we had a lot more fun than we thought we would with the aughts episode. So, here we are, covering the 1930s. An era with not a lot to pick from, in the eyes of Vinny and I, but Professor knows that there's 2,000.
Yes, I would beg to differ on that one. I think that this is jam-packed with horror. Especially foundational horror that kind of set the table for what the genre would be in a lot of ways.
Okay. Well, why don't you start us off with your number 10?
Okay, so my number 10, and for me as we do these lists, I always like to clarify, it's a blend. It's not just the quality of film. I don't think that these are the 10 best
This movies. Is your favorites.
This is a combination of what I think is important, what I think viewers should watch.
Okay.
So number 10, Dracula. This is too important to not have on this list, but at the same time, I recognized that it's very stagey. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a challenge, especially for younger viewers to watch this. But I will make the argument, the first, you know, opening parts of this movie are as good as anything the decade has to offer. With the arrival of Dracula, the staircase, the crane shots in the basement on the track where we roll up to the caskets, armadillos, which I don't know why they're there, but they're there, running across. Very effective scenes, iconic with Lugosi. So for me, out of guilt alone, this has to be in my top 10. So Dracula from 1931, Todd Browning's classic with Bela Lugosi.
I'm just going to jump right on with you. It's my number 10 as well. Again, I felt guilty leaving it off the list. It came down to this and Jekyll and Hyde. And this one, for me, bumped Jekyll and Hyde off of my list just because, as you said, iconic, the sets, and creating the... we have upset Vinny. I have. but also creating what the stereotypical Count Dracula was and would be.
Sure.
For the next 100 years.
Yeah, and there's so many wonderful scenes in it, and I know that we've talked about this movie before on the podcast, but, you know... On the flip side, in fairness, I mean, there's like a great scene I always like to point to that shows the limited nature of the era, where David Manners goes, "Look, a wolf," and they just point to the lawn and look at it, and you don't see anything.
Yeah, stays on the people.
Yeah, everything was very limited. They were trying to figure out still how to effectively place microphones around the set while filming, and so I get it. It's aged. It's, you know, it's dated, but it's still a great midnight movie, even with its limitations.
I have this as number 10 on my list as well.
Okay, so we literally all just lined up on the same pick for number 10.
And
I love it.
And like Grizz, for me, I would feel guilty if I didn't have it on the list. So that's why it gets number 10. I echo what you say. It is very stagey, not necessarily appealing to a new, probably a younger generation. Very early talky, so it's got those issues. There's also, even on the best, even in the best qualities that you can get this on, there's still that hiss to the audio.
Sure. And this is where I'm weird, because there's this almost antiquated element to it that makes it, putting that on at 1 a.m, I don't know how to describe it. It just, this, my father has always referred to them as old creakers, where it actually adds an element to it, but I totally echo, I understand what you're saying,
but
it's going to be tough for some.
I enjoy this movie, like, I put it on, I like, this is something that I have not watched for the last time, by far.
Sure.
I tend to watch Svengoolie when he hosts all these Universal stuff, and if Dracula comes on, I'm going to watch it.
It's also a fun presentation of the story that's not massively involved.
And not only, like Gris said, did this set the precedence of what people thought of for the next 100 years as Dracula, if you were to walk up to an elementary school kid and say, talk like Dracula, they are going to do the Bela Lugosi accent, and they've probably never even seen it.
Oh, yeah.
So, very, very iconic, and like you said, some of those shots, especially, there's that shot where the hand is coming out of the coffin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what era that comes out of, it's a great shot. And Dwight Frye is fantastic as Renfield in this movie.
He is. Dwight Frye is, he's special. And, you know, I also want to point out, too, that we get a scene at the end that's a little bit more grotesque with the stake, and you hear the gasp that comes from that. And so that, thinking of that, I want to make sure I clarify on the topic, because a lot of times context for the decade matters with this format, for this, with these episodes where we're ranking top tens. This involves the code.
Yes.
The code went into effect June 13th, 1934. And so there is a drastic difference in the movies that you have for the first 3.5-4 years, you know, of the decade versus the latter, mm-hmm. Where they're getting away with a little bit more darker stuff.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is an interesting element for ranking movies in this decade.
Sure.
But yeah, that's really cool. We all hit the same movie for number 10.
All right.
Who wants to go with number 9 first?
Vinny, kick us off with your number 9.
Wow, man. I'm going to have to go with The Old Dark House.
Okay.
I like that one. I'm a Charles Laughton fan. I'm a Boris Karloff fan. And so those are both qualities that are present in this movie. This feels very much like a stage show in many ways, a play. Almost puts me in the mind of kind of like an Arsenic and Old Lace kind of thing. I don't know what it is. I just kind of like this movie. I like, especially on a stormy night, I like to watch this movie.
I would invite any listeners who have not seen The Old Dark House but love Texas Chainsaw Massacre to watch it.
Mm.
I think that's an interesting experience, because that's very a very direct way to compare the two. Mm-hmm. The kind of wandering, you have misfortune and you wander in to the weird household.
Yeah.
And so The Old Dark House did not make my top 10, spoiler alert, but this is a direct reflection of, I would make the argument, this is by far, this belongs in the top 10 of most important for the decade for horror. It's just not in my personal top 10. This has so many archetypes. It has so many kind of pillars of the narrative structure for so many horror films come from this. James Whale's eccentric brand of humor doesn't always land with all viewers.
Right.
But that has that there, and it will land for some.
I also like bringing up something that is Karloff's work that is not him as the Frankenstein's monster.
And this is early on, too, when they were really building around the mystique. When we covered this on the podcast previously, we mentioned, you know, he gets billing as just his name,
mm-hmm.
the clarification, you know, the universal stress that it's the same actor. And he was really smart to lean into it, too.
Yeah.
His embracing of that really laid the groundwork for a constantly solid career. But yeah, the Old Dark House, nice choice.
Yeah, I didn't dislike it. I just didn't make my list. My number nine is... I'm going to get a lot of flack for this. Son of Kong.
Oh, wow.
Okay, here's the fun curveball. Is I thought when you said I'm going to get a lot of flack for this, it's because it should be higher. You meant differently. I got you now.
Go ahead. Wow.
I remember you really liking this when we did the King Kong episode.
Yeah, I think that is part of why I like it so much, is that I did not expect myself to like this. It was cranked out in the same year as the first movie. Yeah,
pretty close.
Within a calendar year.
Yeah, within a calendar year. Yeah. Yeah, just a weird movie with a weird Son of Kong who makes weird noises, but he's just kind of cute as can be, and he just won my little heart over.
I want that whole thing on a t-shirt.
You know what? After that review, everybody just rapidly read your top 10. We're done.
You know me when I do these top 10s. I do like to throw some quirky ones out there that appealed to me from that decade. Like when we did the 80s. Like, there's better films from the 80s, but I had to bring up Motel Hell. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
There's just these things that...
I'm with you. That's why we're here. We want people to check out some movies that we like that maybe don't always get talked about. Son of Kong, not always on top 10, so...
Can tell you for sure it's not on my top 10.
Yeah, wasn't even written down on the list of the pool to choose from, but I love that you picked it. I really do.
Oh, man.
Switching it up.
That's all I got to say about that. Yeah,
that surprised me. I can't say that I agree with you on that choice, but I respect you. I respect your opinion.
All right, keeping things interesting.
My number nine was Dr. X from 1932. Warner Brothers, and spoiler alert, there is another one on this list that's also a Warner Brothers two-strip Technicolor. It's very important to me to try and get people to watch.
Two-strip Technicolor from what year?
32.
Wow.
And in a lot of ways, it almost makes these movies feel like a nightmare. With the visual presentation.
I don't think I've ever seen this.
So my hope is that I really maybe get at least a few listeners to check out these movies, because we spend so much time, and rightfully so, dwelling on the Universal Classic Monsters catalog, and there'll be plenty of those still to mention. But these are very effective, very slick, pre-code, pretty creepy movies. This one especially has the gimmick of synthetic flesh, which I used to mimic as a child often. It did not earn me any new friends, but I sure had fun doing it. Specifically, I would do it in the bathtub with the shampoo and the bubbles. In the movie, he creates synthetic flesh and turns himself into a monster. He cakes this shit onto him. But Lionel Atwill's in there, Faye Ray, which we've discussed in the past, King Kong. She made a string of 5 consecutive pre-code horror movies. They're all excellent.
Interesting.
And this is one of them. So I wanted to make sure I highlighted this. This wouldn't make a lot of people's top 10, but it certainly makes mine. I particularly like these two strips at around Halloween time. They have such a mood to them. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of gimmicks, too, where we've got almost like a panel witnessing events that they bring out as they investigate things, and you kind of get some of those classic whodunit elements mm-hmm. from that era that were very popular in there. But it's this is one of the ones that I had to make sure hit my list, because I really want people to check this out. There's wonderful Blu-rays put out by Warner if you're interested in, as a collector, in picking those up. They're really good. But yeah, Dr. X from 1932, worth your time.
Okay.
And that's my number 9. I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I lead off with number 8.
Yeah.
Number 8, The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Charles Laughton. The sets. I mean, the sets are just unreal. Anybody go back me up?
Oh, yeah. this is much higher on my list.
Okay, yeah, I figured it was. But yeah, I'd never seen it until we did our Hunchback episode, and I was just blown away by the acting and the sets.
Not and all on that same vein, when I first saw it, couldn't believe the makeup.
Yeah.
For the era that it was put out.
Sure.
Like it looks, there's not a seam or a line that you notice through this thing on that makeup. It looks completely legit. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the sets are incredible. It's just an absolutely fantastic production.
It was one that I sat down not really looking forward to and was blown away by the end of it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It did not find Sanctuary on my top 10.
Oh, man, we are not friends anymore.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful version of the film.
You are partial, more partial to the Lon Chaney, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. Awesome. I love it simply for the... there was a mystique to Chaney mm-hmm. for me early on with this guy that just could make himself up and all these...
Pop quiz, how many faces did he have?
1,000.
1,000.
And the acrobatics of watching him scale, and that just fascinated me. Mm-hmm. His movements that he had, there was almost a cadence to it. But at the same time, I don't want to try and make any any false pretenses on the fact that I understand Lawton really brings the heart to the forefront. There is a very emotional mm-hmm. force that waves just through that 39 adaptation.
I respect any actor who takes on this role because I know physically how difficult it must be.
Yeah. Sure.
Even just sitting in the makeup chair for that long, but then, you know, just for the weight of prosthetics and just everything else, I have an enormous respect for any actor who ever played Quasimodo.
Yeah. Excellent choice.
Thank you. What is your number 8?
My number 8 is The Invisible Man. I think that it is timeless. It's still, and I, you know, we covered this on the podcast, so I won't drone on too long about it, but the special effects still look wonderful. I mean, we are coming up on 100 years later. It still looks fantastic. It's still very entertaining. And if we're being honest, it's still pretty scary if you really want to allow yourself to think about what you're seeing and what it would be like to deal with it. It's not going to have the on-screen chilling effects that other horror films will, even from that era. But I do think the fact that he's derailing entire trainloads of people, among other things, it's very sinister. It also still falls into that pre-code category where we could get away with something like that. That train situation wouldn't happen 2 years later.
No.
James Whale absolutely dominates this decade with his contributions.
Absolutely.
And I'm guessing maybe this is higher on some lists, but for me, it's at number 8 solely because I don't find it as scary as some of the others or chilling, but nonetheless, still wildly entertaining and fantastic.
I've actually got The Invisible Man right there as well.
Oh, man. Okay.
And in recent years, I have seen this movie on the big screen in a movie theater. And I have also seen this movie at the drive-in in the last calendar year. And I don't mind seeing it over and over again. Again, Svengoolie shows it quite a bit with the and I watch it every time that it comes on. The visual effects are so... they're simplistic today to look at how some of these effects were pulled off, but I'm still equally as impressed with how they did it. Claude Rains essentially just being a voice actor for this movie,
mm-hmm.
I don't think they could have cast that any better. It's just a lot of fun. One thing that does take it down a notch for me is I forget the actress's name from Bride of Frankenstein screaming.
Oh, yeah.
Through the whole fucking movie.
Uno O'Connor.
It's too much in this movie.
I agree completely. I don't mind her screaming even in other movies.
No.
But it gets to the point of intrusive and
too
distracting
much.
In The Invisible Man. I'm with you.
But no, I agree with you. No, on number 8, Invisible Man.
Okay. Didn't make my list.
Yeah.
Now you hate me. I know.
Yeah.
So.
No. You like what you like.
So then that.
Invisible Man didn't make it, but Son of Kong did. That's cool.
So what, Vinny kickoff number 7 here?
Yep, Vinny gets kickoff number 7.
Oh, jeez. So many to choose from. Okay, this might be higher on one person in particular, but Son of Frankenstein.
Higher on mine.
Higher on mine.
And spoiler, I don't have Bride on my top 10. And the reason why, there are a couple reasons why.
Yeah, I'm the same, by the way. I'll echo that.
Son, I like because of Bela
as it's Igor. It's his best acting.
Oh, yeah.
Bela's fantastic, and Igor adds so much to this movie. It's your final portrayal of the monster by Boris Karloff, who fucking owned the role on film. It's so much fun. And what I don't like about Bride, and it's the only gripe I have with Bride, I don't like the creature speaking. And it's the only time that he's presented in Universal as speaking. And I think it works for that film, but I'm not a particular fan of it. But there's just something about it. I mean, you've still got some swashbuckling elements because of Basil Rathbone being in the movie. You've taken... I'm a huge fan of the Frankenstein monster in Universal. But I just feel like this is a fun romp with that character, adding in some new elements. And I don't know, it's just... I really like Son of Frankenstein.
Yeah, it's definitely higher on my list.
That's what I figured.
I love it, and I'll gush. I agree with everything you said, and I'll just gush a little bit more when that time comes.
Kind of the same for me, but I will echo with The Bride. It's not on my list either, and it's mainly because I didn't want my top 10 to turn into like half James Whale or half Frankenstein movies. Yeah. The Bride is fantastic.
I love it.
It's one of the better sequels of all time. I get that. But at the same time, it also leans into humor and fantasy a little bit more to where... it doesn't have the same charm that I particularly love. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's not on there. Cause it's important to clarify that because this would be a lot of people's number one.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not even making top tens here. So I at least want to clarify a little bit on that, what's going
and
on.
And I'm sympathetic to the creature in Bride.
Because I recognize it's good.
I'm sympathetic to the creature in Bride. And Son of Frankenstein, I'm more afraid of it.
Yeah, sure. Well... my number 7 is Bride of Frankenstein.
Okay. That works.
And again, I was worried about half of my list being Frankenstein movies, but here we are. And it's my third favorite Frankenstein movie. But there is just something about the ending with this one. And just the idea. It's so funny because like if you go to Hot Topic right now, you know, you're going to have all this Bride of Frankenstein stuff where it's, you know, it's the creature and the bride madly in love with each other. That's not how the movie works.
Yeah, which is hilarious because, not at all.
Not at all. And it's like, that, I think to me, that was the sucker punch the first time I watched Bride is just like, oh, yeah, he's getting him a bride. That'll be tight. And at the end, it's like, oh, that's sad.
Yeah, she doesn't even want him.
Yeah, she does. Like, humanity doesn't want anything to do with him. And now the bride that's been made for him doesn't want
him. Is terrified of him.
Yes. So, if not for anything, I put it on the list just because the nuance of that.
Well, you have plenty of company on.
Sure, that. I know.
It's an excellent movie.
Yeah. Professor's number 7.
We'll just keep Lugosi and Karloff back in the conversation here. The Black Cat from 1934.
Not on my list, but I knew for a fact it was going to be on yours.
This is another one of my passion movies I need more people to watch. They got this in right before the code really got enforced.
It's a wild watch for its time period.
It's jaw-dropping.
I told myself, I promised myself I was going to watch it for this episode. Didn't happen.
Well, there's always time. This gets into some pretty wild stuff. It's one of the better balances of Lugosi and Karloff's material, so it's a wonderful showcase for them. I also am very fond of The Raven, but with this, I mean, we've got Karloff sitting up out of bed with his widow's peak and the woman laying next to him there. And as we go, we've got a collection of dead women on display that he's keeping in this house. It's just one of the few movies from that era when you watch it where you're like, am I really seeing this? And the fact that you have icons of the genre from that time that we're used to seeing in much more restrained cinema, it's even more compelling. Mm-hmm. So this is one where it's another kind of ending, like you get the car that gets off with stranded and they end up at Karloff's place Karloff and Lugosi have a past from wartime and a backstory there. But you really, it's kind of the more of the classic ending up in the weird spot out of necessity. And it gets really dark. And it's just, if you love these guys, Karloff and Lugosi, you have to watch this. It's just, it's absolutely one of the most interesting movies. Yeah. And like the two-strip Technicolor films I was talking about, this is the other one that had to be on my list.
Yeah.
I want people to see this. And my hope is that somebody listens and goes, okay, extreme pre-code with Karloff and Lugosi, I'll check it out.
Sure.
It's out there. It's a good time.
Suggestions to me when they are prefaced with pre-code always kind of make my ears perk up a little bit. Because I remember the first time I saw a movie before I really realized what the code was. And I remember watching it going, holy shit, this is kind of racy for such and such time.
Sure. It actually lives up to the labels.
Yeah. And so then to learn about the code later and understand why things changed. I'm a lifelong comic book nerd, so I always understood with the comics code authority thing that happened that censored a lot of comics. I was familiar with that, and I'm like, well, yeah, it makes sense. They would have done that with movies as well, and this is a prime example of that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's distinct, and it comes with the highest recommendation. Because you listen to podcasts, check out movies you haven't seen before. This is one for some of you. Check it out.
Nice. Nice. I'll watch it one day. I promise you.
I believe you.
I promise you.
Right after Planet of the Apes.
All right, I believe I'm kicking off number 7.
Wish you would.
Okay.
Well, that was my number 7. He kicked off number 7.
Number 6. I'm kicking off number 6.
Yes.
Wish you cared.
I can't count. Bela Lugosi again. White Zombie.
Ooh. It's a good one.
Yeah. It's one that, like, when I watched it, I was not sure how I felt about it. I felt maybe the pacing was a little slow, but the more I've thought about it over the years, I like the idea of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm always a mark for voodoo movies. We know that about me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, the more the story sank in, the more I liked the movie. It's not something I'm going to watch all the time, but I think it's a really a decent contribution to the decade.
Oh, it is. It didn't make my top 10, but I think that there's enough there that it can be really interesting for a viewer, especially interested in Lugosi. Now, full disclosure, in the past, Mad Chan had picked this for
mash.
Tapping into more vintage themes with the picks. And I questioned it. I was like, you sure you want to do that? Because he hadn't watched it yet. I was like, this isn't the easiest to watch. So, full disclosure, it is very early talky. Same with Dracula.
It's up there with Dracula where you really got to let some of your imagination, like,
sure, but in the same time, or in the same way that Dracula has it, you also have magnetic close-ups of Lugosi and see much of what his iconic presence had to offer, especially in that era. So I think there's a lot of interesting elements to it to make it worth a watch for sure.
Sure.
This movie, I think, of course, obviously you're going to recognize the name because of Rob Zombie's band name. But this is a movie that's famously in the public domain. So many of a horror host have shown this movie. And this is one of those, honestly, few examples of public domain movies that are actually good to watch. A lot of it is public domain for a reason. There's a reason people didn't re-up.
You know, back in the day when you would pick up the, 10 movies on a $5 DVD at Walmart, it either had Night of the Living Dead as the headliner or this.
Yes. But it is, and it's zombies before George Romero redefined the word. It's that voodoo type of deal. And
let's be honest, I mean, it's going to be shocking for an audience at the time to see a white woman turned into a zombie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? For cultural norms.
But it's another, in my opinion, iconic role for Bela Lugosi. And I think that anybody who is... if you're interested in Bela Lugosi after having seen Dracula, you certainly have to watch this to get more of what the man was and what he contributed to the genre.
Yeah.
I concur.
Professor, you're number 6.
My number 6, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from 1931. We've covered it on the show before. It's still a wonderful watch. Frederick March is magnificent in it. There are in-screen effects with gel and the lighting that we've talked about in the podcast.
That's what I always remember when I think of this movie.
That is really good. I actually just got Frederick March's autograph, which is my newest addition to my little collection, which I'm very proud of. I've got the nice picture up with him from that movie. So, yeah, this is a favorite. This is a influence from my father, who may categorize this as one of his favorites, or I don't know if for horror or even that decade, but it's certainly up there. This is one that was a big deal. I remember him talking about going to Cinevent in Columbus and getting like a copy struck at the event there for it back before everybody had, you know, VHSs and DVDs of everything. So this was sought after as a staple of monster kid interest, and it's carried over. I think it's fantastic. And again, this leans into the pre-code stuff. There's some pretty racy things that show up in this movie. And for a guy who didn't have a career that had any roots in this genre, nor did he really afterwards, he sure as hell made an impact with this. So it's a favorite.
This is on my list, but it's higher, so I'll gush about it when it comes higher for me.
Cool.
What's your number six then? Oh, wait, I was going to say real quick,
yeah,
on the same note. Didn't make my list. It just got edged out at the end. But yeah, I'll always remember you explaining to us on the podcast how they did the effect with the color gel and being like, huh, pretty smart.
Yeah, I can just imagine being in the theater for that. never having seen something like that before. Barrymore did a little bit in Jekyll and Hyde in the silent movie, but but just a holy shit moment.
People just running out of the theater screaming.
Oh my God. It's like eating bad buffalo chicken dip. Just getting sick everywhere.
All right. Vinny.
Island of Lost Souls.
Ooh, higher on my list.
And again, you get Charles Laughton, who I love, and you get Bela Lugosi again in a smaller role.
Are we not bleed? Are we not men?
I am a huge fan of the Dr. Moreau story.
You send us pictures of it.
I will watch any version. To me, to date, this is the best version
I agree.
That's ever been put to film.
I don't
think
it's ever been touched. Lancaster in the 70s, that one had some stuff to it, but man, nothing.
But still doesn't add up. And I wish that, like, I thought the creature effects were fine in the one with Val Kilmer and Marlon Brando, but there was so much more at play in that distracted from that movie as a whole and made it not really come together.
Yeah, like the earpiece that he was fed the lines.
This is the best version that's ever been put to film. I think that Laughton is
Who is it, by the way, an unsung hero of this topic that I didn't even think about until we're sitting here. This is now the third movie Charles Laughton has been picked
just
for.
Yep. Sinister and taking delight.
Oh, he's so good.
Like
The House of Pain.
Oh, man, yeah.
It's just, and honestly, and for its time, makeup is decent. Where they have people using people who are amputees to replace a leg with something that looks more like a goat leg and things like that. It's just really good. I really like this movie a lot. Again, I'm a huge Charles Laughton fan, and that's something that has become a recent thing within the last decade for me, for him, and of course Bela being in it and just being Bela, and I just have an affinity for Bela Lugosi.
Yeah, that didn't make my list, but again, I love it. That's such a good movie.
It's higher on my list. I'll gush a little bit more about it when we get to it, but I'll just say this on the topic of Charles Laughton. I think this is the first movie I ever saw Charles Laughton in, and I was just immediately captivated.
Yeah.
By his acting. Yeah. Okay. That wraps up number sixes, and I believe Professor gets to lead us off.
Did you do your number six?
Yes, I did.
Are you sure?
I thought I kicked number six
intros?
Off with Jekyll.
I did White Zombie.
Did we do intros?
Okay.
Number five.
So, for me?
Yep.
Okay. Number five, Werewolf of London.
Didn't make it.
Even if it didn't have the importance for the category of werewolf movies, I just flat out think it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Needs to be picked.
Now, I thought this one came out in the 80s.
So this... for people who are kind of working backwards, I think they may see it and go, oh, he's not as done up.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I understand that. But the reality is this is before the Wolfman.
Yep.
And it's really good.
Mm-hmm. It is.
His makeup looks good. Henry Hall was a very gifted performer. And he doesn't pull any punches because of the material. He's excellent in it. It's a very important movie because you have such a limited amount of good movies for a category that people love.
Mm-hmm.
People love werewolf movies. There's not a lot of good ones.
No.
And this was the first real decent werewolf movie. It had to be in my top five because, well, I enjoy it that much. But also, I want more people to watch it. I know we've talked about it in the past, but it had to be brought up again. For listeners, if you haven't watched the movie, just hop on Google real quick and type in Werewolf of London and look at the images. And tell me you don't want to watch that. He looks sinister.
Yeah. Cool. The last time I watched this was when we did our Werewolf Roundtable, and it had been a few years since I had watched it. It is more of a Jekyll and Hyde type of presentation of a werewolf. But again, does predate the Wolfman, and I do really enjoy watching this movie, and it just barely did not make my top 10 list. Just barely.
Mm.
Have you ever seen it?
Still haven't seen it.
I
know.
Dying.
You guys are upset. All right. Vinny, you're number five.
That would be The Hunchback of Notre Dame with okay. Charles Laughton.
Yeah.
Sanctuary!
Sanctuary!
The way he swings in, I love it. Just defying all rules of gravity when he swings back to the church.
It's very moving, though.
As the man in the moon.
Also love when he's dumping the hot oil on the
people. Oh, man. With delight.
Yes. All right. My number five is Frankenstein.
Much higher on my list.
Much higher on my list as well.
You know, I spent my whole life loving the Wolfman, and I even have a Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman tattoo portrait on my leg. But as time has gone on, I've realized that as far as a franchise go, I'm much more of a Frankenstein guy for the Universal
100%.
Stuff. And I think everybody is. Yes. I mean, they're just a better series of movies.
It's the most dominant property in terms of the quality that they maintain through them. Because even you could look at something like Wolfman and be like, well, they made, oh, look, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. There's Frankenstein. I mean, the movies along the way were excellent.
Right. Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein. Yep. You know,
it's just, House of Frankenstein.
Right.
Only rivaled by the character of Dracula.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't have a whole lot to say about this film. It's pretty self-explanatory why people like it. And I'm sure you guys will go into it at length.
Yeah, I'll gush about it more later for sure.
I'm going to hold you at gunpoint with one of your own guns while I talk about it.
Okay. That means Vinny gets to kick us off at number four.
I think that number four is going to be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde with Frederick March. Like the professor said, my dad was a big fan of the Jekyll and Hyde story growing up, so I think that had a big influence on me and having an interest in it as well. I love, again, special effects, that whole lighting and gel to create that effect where you, no cutaway, you watch the transformation begin to happen in one shot is still incredible to me. And so simple in nature. I'm always going to be way more impressed with that than I am with a CGI transformation scene. It's just, that's who I am, and that's how it's always going to be. I love watching an actor play that duality. Any version of Jekyll and Hyde that is out there, I will watch at least once. But part of that for me is the transformation. You have to have, it's like a werewolf movie. The transformation scene better be good if you expect to draw me in with it.
And that's with the Spencer Tracy one that they made the following decade isn't as popular with people because he didn't get as extreme.
And as the movie progresses, Hyde becomes more and more simian and just ghoulish looking. Like he becomes more and more of a monster each time he makes the transformation. Again, pre-code, so there's a lot of things that are a surprise to you as you watch it with what they're talking about, just content. But yeah, for sure, this one is one of my favorites ever.
Lots of interesting POV camera work for him. And again, I just to echo basically what I already said. It's just such a powerhouse performance.
Yeah. Okay. My number four, Kang Kong.
Higher for me.
Okay. I expected that.
Higher for both of you.
But not by much.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, just loved when we did the King Kong episode and revisiting this and all the stuff on Skull Island with the, you know, the dinosaurs and other stuff there. And yeah, and then thinking like, oh yeah, just comparing this with like the Peter Jackson version and watching Peter Jackson's and like how he really nails the first 40 minutes, right? Because it's so much calling back to the original, and then it goes on for 6 more hours and you're not having fun anymore. But to see that, like, how just in the time that this came out and for a giant monkey movie, how well made it is and how good the story is.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'll save my gushing for a little bit higher.
Same.
Okay. Number four. Number four, Son of Frankenstein for me.
Okay.
still
hanging out on my list.
And here's the thing, this, once we get into kind of these, like, you know, well, really for the top 10, I guess, in general, with this decade, so much of it's interchangeable. Ask me next week, I may feel a little bit differently, but Son of Frankenstein is still one of the most entertaining movies that the Universal horror catalog ever put out. Even if you don't find it moving or scary or any of those things, it's just really good.
The house is a really cool set.
Yeah, the sets are awesome. This is, and I know I've referenced this on the show before, this birthed a whole second wave of horror at Universal because this helped pull them out of the ashes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was tough times, and this was wildly popular. It's one of the longer entries you'll have for horror movies from back then, and it never feels like it. It moves swiftly. The cast is fantastic. It's just... it's really good. Karloff looks great in it.
Yeah.
The sets with the swooping in and the bubbling lava shit, and it's just, it's so much fun.
So fun.
Well, hello!
Yes.
That's my number four, Son of Frankenstein, just before the end of the decade there in 39.
Vinny, you're number four.
Did I do number four?
Oh, did you start us with number four? Maybe you did.
Did we do interest?
All right, then I'm kicking us off at number three here.
Let's do it.
My number three is Todd Browning's Freaks.
Mm.
Is that yours as well?
Sir. I like that one. Yes, sir.
Did not make my list, but I
love
it. Yeah, I love it, though.
God, you're off the show.
You are uninvited from this
movie. Yeah. You guys think there's 7 good movies from the decade, so give me a break here.
I love this. I've, you know, Vinny is obviously much more into this niche interest market than I am, but I've always loved carnies and carnival stuff and sideshow and freak show and all this sorts of things. I love the history behind it. You know, I love the flim flam. You know what I mean? I love that. But, you know, this is so good. It's just, I think of it again as another masterpiece of filmmaking. So,
For me, I agree with everything you just said. The only reason that I don't have this in my top 10 is this never scared me in the same way. Like, even as a kid, I was more sympathetic. Now, that doesn't mean I'm not doing the snarky thing where I'm saying it's not a horror movie or anything like that. But my experience with it was more sympathetic to the characters. I think it's a wonderful movie. But that's really the only reason that...
Ruined the man's career.
Yeah, when I'm making 50-50 calls here, I mean, it's on my honorable mentions right there. This could easily be right there in the top 10. So it's a wonderful, excellent. This is Todd Browning's best movie,
and I love that we get the ending we want. You know what I mean? The revenge.
Yes.
On the awful person.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some of that shit is pretty intense.
Yeah. Oh man.
Crawling down there
in the rain. Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw this for the first time.
This year, number three. Or number four? What are we on? Number three is mine.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my number three. The first time I saw this, which is probably, it's 20 plus years ago, my mind was blown by it. I had never seen anything like it. I love the fact that they used actual human oddities, sideshow performers in these roles. That was where I was introduced to Schlitzie for the first time, which just captivated me. And I've done so much research since. One of the things I do enjoy about Schlitzie and Schlitzie's career, Schlitzie wasn't just paraded out on stage to stare at. Schlitzie actually had an act and did some magic tricks in their act. So that's very interesting to me. And Schlitzie, by all accounts, actually enjoyed the performance end of things. Man, it's just so different than anything else that I've ever seen before. Been imitated by several things. American Horror Story had a season where they imitated it poorly. I don't know. I just can't say enough about it. It's so odd because it was banned for a long time.
Yeah.
Especially in the UK, it was banned for a very long time. If you haven't seen it, I don't really want to tell you any more about it. Yeah. I just want you to go and watch it and just have the experience. Some of the acting is a little rough because you're dealing with people who were actual performers, sure, but were not actors.
Right.
But I can easily look past all of that. It's a great flick.
It's also a very interesting example of how quickly the industry was adapting. Because this is Todd Browning, as we discussed with Dracula, and how stagey that was. Mm-hmm. And then you watch this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, okay, he's got it figured out.
Yeah, yeah.
And then on top of that, he grew up in this world.
Oh, yeah.
And so this wasn't... Now, people at the time and since then have looked at this as exploitive, including some of the performers that were in it. There are a few that expressed deep regret for being a part of it later. And there's others who said, no... I'm proud of it, and I loved it.
Little Angelo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the reality is Browning grew up in the circus.
Yeah.
That's what his parents did. And so he knew the world. I think it's shown with affection and also a very vengeful but protective scenario.
Yeah.
So I disagree with that element of it. I think that it was more embracing the culture.
Right.
And I think it's a very entertaining.
Yeah, I don't think it was I don't think it portrayed people in a negative light or took advantage of people.
I agree.
Yeah, we're never laughing at anybody.
No.
Yeah, I just wanted to point that out because if you get somebody that looks up these movies as we talk about them, there's certain to be some of that sure swirls around this. But
stop looking through
today's
lens at things that were created almost 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Very true.
Retcon. Professor.
Number three.
You're number three.
Mystery of the Wax Museum. I think this is actually the creepiest movie of the decade. I think that... And this is the other two-strip Warner Brothers movie, Precode, Fay Wray, Lionel Atwill, same duo from Dr. X. They remade this with Vincent Price in the 50s, which is still really good. But I think that this is chilling. I think Atwill is very sinister in it. It deals, and if you guys don't know the basic premise of it, he's doing a wax museum with famous historical figures, but he's using real corpses, and then he's doing them up. So he's seeking out people that look like Joan of Arc, and then you've got them in there. And so, but you also add in a fire between business partners at the beginning that leaves the one disfigured and terrifying. Who's seeking revenge on the situation. So it's got that, between the two-strip Technicolor and then the sound of the time almost has this weird hum to it, and not in a way that's taxing. It feels like a nightmare. And the movie, I really do think it's got the most chilling moments of anything from the decade. And this was very important to me to hit on these two movies and stress, go seek them out. If you're interested... with movies from that era, you have to see this. It's so good.
Yeah, it sounds fun. Anytime I've read about it, I still need to see it.
I've not seen it.
Well, maybe I'll pick it on an episode so you guys have to at some point. We'll do it.
Well, I started our number three. Vinny chimed in. He would have been the last one on number three. So do you want to kick us off with
your number two?
Yeah.
Sure. King Kong.
King Kong. I've heard of it.
I think it's one of the ultimate accomplishments in film history. We're approaching, like, The Invisible Man coming up on 100 years, and it's still incredible to watch.
Yeah.
The artistry is still on full display, and in a way that they didn't lean into anything that's aged it. You can, once you just sit down and watch it, it's so good. The camera work complements it in a way that even in the time they knew, we want to fool these viewers. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine what it was like to be in a movie theater back then and being like, holy shit. Add to that, Faye Ray selling, back with her again.
Yep.
Again, guys, I stress this, 5 movies in a row and then she left. She didn't make any more genre movies. Just this massive impact as really the first Scream Queen.
Scream Queen.
And her reaction, Scream
Queen.
I'm coming back with that. Her reactions sell the visuals.
Yeah.
Because so much of it is focused on her and that initial reveal. It's, in terms of just film history, it's about as good as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
The ingenuity of Willis O'Brien is just, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
That's my number two, and I'm sticking with it. King Kong from 1933.
Very nice.
That is also my number two.
Very nice.
I echo everything that you have said. It, the fact that they took a stop-motion character and made you care about it as if it was a living, breathing creature, to where that ending, you have that feeling when Kong is shot down off the top of the Empire State, when you watch him fall, is a testament to how well made that was. Again, I'm a special effects nerd, so that really, and like you say, imagine being in the 30s and walking into a theater and seeing a giant gorilla fighting a T-Rex.
Yeah.
And the professor and I got to go see King Kong. Did Todd go with us to that one? I can't remember.
Yes, and Brian Blair. Wasn't that right before COVID was happening?
It was.
We saw the first mass.
And somebody was wearing a mask and latex gloves, and we were like, hey, if you're that fucking worried about it, why are you even fucking coming out of your house? And then the next week, the world shut down.
Yeah, I was going to say, in fairness for context here,
we were the dipshits.
Yeah, this wasn't in the middle of already being informed. No. It's just like, what the hell is this person doing? Yeah, because we went in and I think the seats had been wiped down.
I don't remember.
It was like the very beginning of it.
The next week, the world shut down. But we saw King Kong on the big screen. It's the first time I had ever seen it on the big screen before. And just very innovative with the special effects work that went into it. And it's a testament to how many times, you know, it used to be an annual event that television stations would air that. I think especially in Cleveland, it was Cleveland area. It was around Thanksgiving. They would always air it on the East Coast. Yes, by today's standards, some of the stop motion work is dated,
but not much.
But not really, because I'll tell you what—it
was 100 years ago.
Yeah, because I went and watched the new King Kong movie with Godzilla recently, and look, I went and it was lizard brain, giant monsters fighting each other. But at the same time, I feel like CGI is taking a step backwards. I don't feel like CGI is as good as what it used to be. And I don't feel like when I'm watching that, I feel like I'm watching animation. I don't feel like I'm watching a living, breathing creature right now.
Yeah.
And somehow this stop motion creature tricks me.
Feels more believable.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. My number two, already brought up by Vinny, Island of Lost Souls. Was that on your list?
Ooh, that hit number two for you. I love it.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't on my list. Fantastic, though.
I'll just speak real briefly about it. It's interesting in that in 1994, I was the most excited 12-year-old for The Island of Dr. Moreau to come out. And then I saw it, and I really wasn't sure what happened.
Did you cry? You saw Marlon Brando with white clown makeup on his face?
Yes. And truth be told, because it hit that part of my brain, I don't hate that version of the film.
I don't hate it, but it's a mess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've got the documentary of the making of that one on Blu-ray.
Which is better than the movie.
It's way better than the movie. Isle of Lost Soul? Is it just
Lost Souls?
Lost Souls.
Lost Souls is what it's
called. Yeah, Lost Souls. Yeah. Richard Stanley. And I tell you, when I watched this for the first time a few years ago for the show, I mean, Charles Laughton, it was my first introduction to him. Everything you brought up with the amputees, everything, and just knowing the 12-year-old me in 1994 who tricked myself into liking that version, and now getting to watch a really good version of the story the way it should be told, it just warmed my heart. So, yeah, that's it. That's my number two.
That's an interesting kind of journey with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see where... That would completely make sense, because I had grown up with the old one.
Right.
And so then you got just turd city after turd city. And, you know, affection for some of that in different ways. But the gold standard had been my first, so I could only imagine just seeing kind of insane versions. And then it's like, okay, okay, we got some talent here. This is good.
How do we strip it of all the modern, you know, fetchings that were sure. meant to make it better in the future, and go back to just good storytelling yeah. and good acting
yeah.
and be the superior film?
Yeah. One of the best bursts of Lugosi you'll ever see.
Yeah.
Because, make no mistake, he is not a leading part of the movie.
No.
But his scenes are so fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Totally agree.
Okay. Who gets to do number one?
Is it me?
I believe it is you.
It should be you. Go ahead.
Frankenstein.
Spoiler alert, same.
This movie for me, man, my dad was a huge fan of it, which obviously affected me as well. The reasons that I love it are Colin Clive. And that manic performance is fantastic. Dwight Fry as Fritz. The original Hunchback
sure.
assistant. Mm-hmm. Everyone associates Igor. Igor wasn't a hunchback. Spoiler.
Yeah.
Fritz was the assistant. And Dwight Fry was great in that role. Karloff's... The creature, period... never looked more like a reanimated corpse than it did in this movie.
Yes.
That scene where he first backs out and then turns to the camera and his face is so sunken in, and just the brow and the way the eyes look, all of that. And of course, I mean, the influence of this movie is felt throughout horror for the rest of time. With those lab sets and man, I just can't say enough about how much I love this movie. Yes, it is dated, but I don't think it hurts it in any way.
I wouldn't say I disagree, but I push back in the sense of it's not dated in the way that we've talked about some of the other movies on this
list. No, and I agree with that. I just think I'm looking through the lens of a young person today.
Sure.
And what they have become accustomed to, the way a movie moves, the way it's scored, all of those kind of things. This is going to feel antiquated to a younger viewer. But
not in the way Dracula would.
And that's very true. And that's kind of where I was leaning.
I think that they had moved past, they had learned more what a talking motion picture was by the time this movie was made from where they were when they made Dracula.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree that it's not going to be as jarring and feel quite as antiquated. But I can't say enough about this movie. I really think that this defines the decade as far as horror goes. And just look at the lasting effect that it's had.
So I will gush now. This combines the elements of wow then and now. This would have been absolutely jaw-dropping in the theater back then.
Sure.
The idea of a corpse being put together and then reanimated would have been terrifying.
And Karloff, the famous line being cut out.
Yeah. Karloff, it launched his career. He became this mysterious actor that they kind of build upon with each passing year and the roles that they branch out with. He leans into it. James Whale absolutely just directs the hell out of this movie. As you mentioned, Clive, Fry, they're both fantastic in their roles. And even now, as we close in on a century later, this has so many elements in it that have informed horror movies ever since. And even if you don't agree completely on that note, it still informed the Wallets of the 30s, because this thing boomed. This and Dracula birthed all of this. And in many ways, now maybe there would have been somebody else. You know, it's like there's that classic argument with the Beatles.
If it wasn't them, it would have been somebody else.
Right. And so maybe you have that with horror movies, but the reality is Dracula and Frankenstein just birthed all of this.
Yeah.
And that's why those two properties have went on and on and on and on, but also why the studios went, we need to take this serious and entertain this topic, this genre. We need to branch out with scary movies. This is going to put asses in the seats. So Frankenstein was wildly successful back then, but it has aged incredibly well. Mm-hmm. Karloff is still sympathetic, but also scary at times. The scenes with them out grave robbing at the beginning is what I kick Halloween season off with every year.
Yeah.
It's a bona fide classic.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, everything that we've discussed on this episode is affected by this movie.
Yeah, I would agree.
Absolutely.
So I can't say enough about Frankenstein. I think that it is art and commercialism all intersecting perfectly. I think it's a movie that you can make money off of, but it is also gifted.
And it was risque, and the fact that there were things that had to be cut for the release. You had Colin Clive's famous line of, by God, now I know what it is to be God.
Yeah, that one.
And that got cut. That's blasphemous. You cannot do that.
Can't do that.
And then you had the girl with the flowers when Karloff, the monster, picks her up and throws her in so she'll float like the flowers.
Yeah.
And instead she drowns, which even Karloff did not want.
Yeah, I'm glad
that
you mentioned that
there.
Because that is the most important scene in the movie, mm-hmm. in my opinion, besides creating him.
Right.
But that fully informs the monster.
Yeah.
That's where you develop sympathy.
Yes.
Because he's wanting to relate, but...
Because that shows you that he's not just a criminal brain. It's a underdeveloped brain.
Right.
Yeah. He's simple.
There's a chance for redemption.
He's Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
He doesn't mean to the harm that he just
did.
And
that blossoms out a lot of depth to the movie. And so the idea that people saw that for decades without it is just
crazy.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
But in full agreement. A lot of in sync there on the list. So what's number one for Grizz?
Son of Frankenstein.
Son of Frankenstein. Yeah, you know this. Love it. Yeah. Love it. Never seen it till we did the Frankenstein episode. Absolutely fell in love with it. I don't have anything to say that you all haven't already said about it, but I'll just say the story, the set, the acting, right up from the monster to Lugosi to Rathbone to the little boy to the cop investigating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all right there. Yeah, it's just a blast, as Professor so succinctly put it. It's so much fun. It's almost like a fun action movie in a Frankenstein movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It really elevates it into more fan service in a lot of ways, but it's still got a lot of heart still.
It's like the joke we always make about Tombstone. You can't say Tombstone's the best Western because it's an action movie set in the West.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because... Yeah. But that's why everybody loves it,
right?
And so I think that's why everybody loves this too. It's a great action movie. That's a Frankenstein movie.
An excellent
in the 30s.
Number one. I love that the podcast has helped you land there.
Oh yeah,
it's a good one.
Oh yeah. So, all right.
I've got a couple of add-ons I'd like to throw out. Does anybody have honorable mentions they want to throw out? Are you good?
I think we've covered everything.
Okay, strap in, take a nap, whatever you need. I got some things to go over. Honorable mentions here. I want to make sure I throw out. Freaks was my number 15. Number 14, The Black Room.
Never.
Karloff playing in many ways three roles. Mm-hmm. But he plays twin brothers.
Oh, yeah, I have seen
one of which pretends to be the other one.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's really playing three roles. It's a fascinating exercise.
I remember that in the Karloff documentary we watched.
There you go. Yes. So, yeah, The Black Room, I wanted to mention that. Mark of the Vampire at number 13.
Oh, yeah.
Which is London After Midnight. So if you get interested in the mystique of the Lost Chaney film, you have that there. Also, Todd Browning. Number 12, The Mummy.
Which I'm surprised didn't chart for you.
I love the sequels. I respect the original and its vision and presentation. But if we're talking about 10 movies that chill me and entertain me, it barely missed the
cut. Well, at the end of the day, it's Dracula repackaged.
Yeah, it certainly is. Even down to the shots, it's high drama. But it's important, so I want to mention. And then number 11, The Walking Dead. This hurt me to leave off the list. Because I really want people to watch this one. That's the main reason I'm making sure I mention my honorable mentions here. It gets spiritual. It is very moving. Karloff is put to death wrongfully with, the capital punishment. And if you ever check out the DVD, you can hear my dad mention in the last leg of that. It's a fantastic movie. It's one of Karloff's best acting showcases along with The Black Room.
So. Is there a guy with a crossbow?
No. If Daryl dies, I did not write it. Knocked the air out of me on that one. Dad's mentioned on the commentary for that one. It's an excellent movie, though. And then speaking of him, the guy who made me love this decade contributed his own top 10 list in lieu of us doing this episode. So I want to make sure that I share that with listeners. So this is Professor's father. Sharing his list. Number 10, Son of Frankenstein. Number 9, Werewolf of London. 8, The Black Cat. 7, Wax Museum. 6, Invisible Man. 5, The Mummy. 4, Frankenstein. 3, Dracula. Number 2, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And number 1, King Kong. Runner-ups, Dr. X, Dracula's Daughter, Island of Lost Souls, The Walking Dead. And he said, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
It's a solid list.
Bravo, Mr. Wilson.
So, yes, 30s horror was always big. In our household growing up.
Nice. Well, I think we busted this thing wide open, fellas.
Yeah.
Yes. Hopefully listeners go check out a few ones that they haven't heard of.
There's some I will check out.
For sure. Good. For sure. So, all right. We're wrapping up another episode of Top Tens of the Decades, the 1930s. I'm one of your hosts, Grizzly Abner, and I've been joined by...
Professor Wagstaff.
Venomous Vinny.
Stay scary.